Look with me, if you will, to Galatians chapter 5. Galatians chapter 5, we'll be reading just a couple of verses here as we begin. 2 weeks ago, we noted that our culture is quickly breaking from the traditions that perhaps we've had in the past, and we're seeing lots of things that we never imagined we would see. We'll not go through a laundry list of those, but for a faithful child of God, there's certainly the idea that we are no longer living in a society that is concerned about godly things. And it's not so much that we want to be terribly upset about this and to such a point that it's causing us to lose sleep at night, but instead to determine how we're going to stay in step with the Spirit as our society becomes out of step with God. And so in our first lesson, we noted how there is a war for our soul. Peter tells us that. And so in this war, you've got God who is unwilling to compromise his stand versus the forces of Satan and wickedness that are trying to pull us away in whatever way we can. And so Paul in Galatians chapter 5 gives us a list of characteristics that will describe the one who's getting out of step with God. And he labels this list the works of the flesh, and we looked at the first three of those last week. So if you note with me in verse 19, the apostle says, "Now the works of the flesh are evident, sexual immorality, impurity, sensuality." As we noted in Paul's list, you can't always determine that the most important thing is appearing at the first. Yet, in this list of the works of the flesh, it may very well be that the apostle is starting with what is most tempting to mankind, the things that tend to illustrate themselves in the lives of people who are losing touch with God. And certainly we don't have to look far in our culture to see how that's the case, how things of a sexual nature have been perverted from the way that God wanted them to be into all manner of wickedness. As we continue on the list, however, we come to two that are somewhat different, though perhaps related, especially in certain cultures that ancient Israel dealt with. In verse 20, we come to the next two characteristics where Paul says, one who is walking by the flesh, one who's committing the works of the flesh, is also going to illustrate the sins of idolatry and witchcraft. Now again, as we put these in some of the more well-used translations, whereas last week we saw some variation in the wording with these two, the translators are almost all in step. You see, the only difference is that with the second of these, some are translating witchcraft, while some are translating sorcery, yet ultimately those two things boil down to the same meaning. And so this morning, what I want us to do is to talk about these two works of the flesh, to understand what they are, and to understand how, even in the 21st century, in the United States of America, these works of the flesh still are very, very major temptations for us. So let's begin with this idea of idolatry. When we talk about idolatry, what is it that we're actually referring to? Well, the word's pretty easy. You take two words and you put them together, and it's idols and worship. And here you've got the concept of idolatry. And so the point that's made from really the book of Genesis on is that when one is practicing idolatry, one is seeking to find a replacement for Jehovah. Instead of serving Him, you're looking to serve someone or something else. And so as we look throughout the Bible, we find it is replete with warnings against idolatry. In particular, when we look at the Old Testament and Israel's dealings with the nations around them, we know that it was a problem before they went into Canaan, but when they get into Canaan, it is going to be a stumbling block in so many ways. And that's why Moses, before they go into the land, is warning the people over and over, you must be careful about these people that you're going to be around because of what they practice. And thus, as he laid the foundation of the law, here God says in Exodus chapter 20, verses 3 and 4, "You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above or that is in earth beneath or that is in the water under the earth." I think that's a pretty inclusive description. where God is saying, when you go into this land, you're going to find people there who have made images of the heavens and images of things on the earth and things in the water, and they're bowing down to these. You had better not allow yourself to become involved with those things. And then, just as they're about to go in the land, as Moses is giving these final speeches to them, he says, you shall not have a God before me. You shall not go after those other gods, the gods of the peoples who are around you. You can't get any plainer than that. So here is the warning. Yet, what happens? We know. We know that while God warned over and over about idolatry, this was a sin that was quite appealing to the people for a host of reasons. Let me just give one illustration, which I think is so telling. When we get to the time of King Manasseh, you'll remember what he did. The carved image of Asherah that he made, he set in the house of which the Lord said to David and to Solomon his son, in this house and in Jerusalem, which I've chosen out of all the tribes of Israel, I will put my name forever. Manasseh, in his wickedness, takes this idol, this statue to a false god, and he puts it in the Lord's temple. And though he repented later, this was the line crossed in the sand. And you'll note what the Lord says on down when he says, because Manasseh, king of Judah, has committed these abominations and has done things more evil than all that the Amorites did who were before him, and has made Judah also to sin with his idols. And he goes on to say they're going into captivity. They're going into punishment because of this. Here's where the sin leads. A nation with such promise, a nation with the blessings of God, a nation that had God watching over them says, we want to exchange you for something else. And look at the consequences of that. Yet when we change testaments, we don't change the warning in the least. Because in the New Testament, God continues with that very thing. We think about as we get to 1 Corinthians chapter 10, passage David alluded to this morning, as Paul is warning here the Corinthians about their habit of going into the idols' temples and partying with them and eating and saying, well, this is no big deal. He takes them back in the history of Israel and he says, consider them. Are not those who eat the sacrifices participants of the altar? What do I imply then? That food offered to idols is anything, or that an idol is anything? No. I imply that what pagans sacrifice, they offer to demons and not to God. I do not want you to be participants with demons. Now listen to what Paul's saying. He's saying that idol may not be anything, that piece of wood or stone sitting in front of you may not be anything, but the origin of these things is something major. The origin of idolatry, the origin of turning against God, this is from a demon itself. This is from the devil. And he says, you cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons. You cannot partake of the table of the Lord and the table of demons. In other words, there's no combining the two. There's no serving the idol on Saturday night and God on Sunday morning. These things must be put away. We continue. And what we find in the New Testament then is that many times these warnings about idolatry are much more than warnings about images of wood and stone. In fact, that idea goes back to the Old Testament as well. You think about what Ezekiel said concerning the people of his day. God speaking through him says, son of man, these men have taken their idols into their hearts. You ever thought about that phrase? And set the stumbling block of their iniquity before their faces. Should I indeed let myself be consulted by them? It's not only that they were worshiping these idols of stone and wood, but he says they have taken idols into their heart. In other words, whether there's a piece of wood in front of them or not, they've given themselves to something besides to me. We think about Paul's warning in the book of Colossians chapter 3 when he says, put to death therefore what is earthly in you, sexual immorality, impurity, passion, evil desires, and covetousness, which is idolatry. So whether it's an image or whether it's an idea or whether it's a pursuit, if it comes before God, Paul is telling us it is a work of the flesh and it's showing who's winning the battle for your soul. So is there an idol in my heart? Is there something that I've placed before God? Really, the answer is to ask this question. What do I live for? What is it that's important to me? What gets me up in the mornings? And when I answer that question honestly, I can determine whether or not God is the one who I serve, or if it's something else. Let's think about the other word. As we think about the witchcraft or the sorcery, however that's translated, we think about its origin, and it's really quite interesting to look at where this word comes from in the Greek language, just because of a word that we have very closely associated. You look at that word and suddenly an English word comes to mind, and that's pharmacy. Now, we're not going to accuse our pharmacist in the crowds of being sorcerers, but yet that's where this particular idea comes from. Because what they did would be to mix these narcotic ingredients to try to create some kind of deception with them. And so they would mix these things. Someone would come to the idol's temple, and the priest or the sorcerer who's ever serving there would make it appear that this god is either correcting a problem, or if you wanted to create a problem for someone, that the god is creating that problem. And it all came through this deception, but just like drugs today are very addictive, so were they then. And so someone would go away with this feeling that everything was okay, and perhaps even in a state of mind created by these narcotics, that would wear away. And then it was a trip back to the idol's temple to figure out what else could be done. So here was their source of power, these pagan gods that were made to look like they were creating havoc through these things that were taken. Though he did not use a narcotic, the illustration is very well understood with King Ahaziah. You remember back in 2 Kings 1 and verse 2, Ahaziah has an accident. He falls through the lattice in his upper chamber in Samaria and he lays sick. So he sent to his messengers telling them, "Go inquire of Baal-zebub, the god of Ekron, whether I shall recover from this sickness." And that's what's so irritating to God. He says, "Do you not have a God in Israel that you can ask? That you must go to this pagan God?" Yet what Ahaziah did is what many have done and even continue to do in some senses now. What does God think about all of this? Well, it's no surprise to us that it doesn't meet his approval. I want to take you to a passage that I think is so telling over in the book of Isaiah. He says, through Isaiah, "And when they say to you, 'Inquire of the mediums and the necromancers who chirp and mutter,' should not a people inquire of their God? Should they inquire of the dead on behalf of the living, to the teaching and to the testimony? If they will not speak according to this word, it is because they have no dawn." Listen to what he says. He says, you're going to go to something supernatural. You're going to try to talk to a spirit. You're going to go to the dead. You're going to go to this pagan priest instead of to me. What a shame. And what we find here is God saying, "I'll have none of that." But I suppose some of the strongest language given to a sorcerer is what John read to us just a few minutes ago. As you think about the Apostle Paul and this dealing with Eliamus, I want you to go kind of to the heart where Paul is speaking to him and listen to what he calls him here. He looked intently at him and said, "You son of the devil, you enemy of all righteousness, full of deceit and villainy." Here was one who was trying to prevent the ways of God from being heard. And perhaps that was through some of his magic, through some of his incants, perhaps some of the pharmacy he was doing here. But whatever the case, the apostle says, "You have nothing to do with God." And that illustrates the point that we're seeking to make this morning with those works of the flesh. If you are involved in those things, you are not involved with God. So let's take this to the very practical now. When we think about where we are and the moment in time we're in, how do these two works of the flesh relate to us? I doubt that if we took a survey, we would get much over 1% of Americans who bow down to an idol. I'm sure there are a few who do that, and religions that have been brought into the United States from other cultures, maybe some of those people still do. But the average American has no statue in his house, no idol of wood or stone that he's bowing down to. And though there is some fascination with paganism today, I imagine it's well under 1% of Americans who are mixing ingredients and trying to cast spells and do things of that nature. So would we say that we have beat the system on this? That in our culture, though as wicked as it might be, we don't have any problems with idolatry and sorcery? Well, before we give ourselves credit, let's do a little bit of exploring of this idea. And I want us to go back to the question that we introduced earlier, and that being to ask ourselves, what do I live for? And I want us to go back to a passage we looked at earlier from Colossians chapter 3, where Paul says, "Put to death, therefore, what is earthly in you, sexual immorality, impurity, passion, evil desire, and covetousness, which is idolatry." Now you'll note here, this has nothing to do with bowing down to a statue. This has nothing to do with mixing narcotics to try to get some kind of result from that. In fact, as you look at the definition of this word covetous, here are some of the words that come to mind: avarice and aggression and a desire for advantage. Here are people, the Apostle Paul is saying, who have so given themselves to the idea that I want to get ahead in this life, that I want to have more than everybody else, that I want to have a big bank account, that I want to have lots of stuff, that's the idol in their temple. That's what they bow down to. And that passage is so reminiscent of warnings given by Jesus himself. You remember what we find in Luke chapter 12 and verse 15? Where Jesus says, "Take care and be on your guard against all covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions." There are a lot of our fellow Americans that in the last 3 weeks have learned this lesson. Things that they worked for their entire lives washed away in just a matter of hours. Did Jesus know what he was talking about? If any one of those citizens said, "Well, my life is over, everything I've worked for is gone," they're guilty of the sin of idolatry. Because as I look at my house and my stuff and my bank account, and if I say, "This is where I've invested my life, this is where my life consists," I am so guilty of this work of the flesh. Thus we heed the warning of Jesus when he says this: "No one can serve two masters. For either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other." And note the language: you cannot serve God, the older translation of mammon and the newer of money. You cannot serve God on the one hand and have this greed and this desire for stuff on the other. And thus, as we've talked about even in recent weeks, we must be awfully careful. Because this is a sin that creeps up on us. And very few people will admit to themselves that they're guilty of the sin of materialism. But yet it is something that I believe tempts us in our day perhaps as much as any other. Therefore, we're cautious and we're on guard. But that's not where it stops. While greed and covetousness certainly is a part of it, it extends well beyond that. I think about a passage that we look at from the Apostle Paul that's going to be very reminiscent of Galatians 5. When we think about in Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 19, where he says, "They have become callous and have given themselves up to sensuality, greedy to practice every kind of impurity." So here are several of those words that we've been looking at. The idea that the flesh has become so strong that the desire to satisfy the physical urges, the desire to be involved in the perversions of God's laws on sexual things, that has become a god to people. And what a danger that is. Yet once again, how many have fallen prey to it? Whether it be through pornography or whether it be through actually pursuing a physical relationship, that there are those who have made that their god. That's what they live for. And what a dangerous thing that is. We think as well about God's warning concerning power. So interesting that oftentimes false teachers are the ones who are described in this way of having made this their God. That's certainly what we find in 2 Peter. Same word as covetous that we looked at earlier in Colossians. Peter says, and in their covetousness or their greed, they will exploit you with false words. Their condemnation from long ago is not idle, and their destruction is not asleep. They have eyes full of adultery, insatiable for sin. They entice unsteady souls. They have hearts trained in greed, accursed children. Here are people who are so concerned about getting a following that what they're willing to do is to give themselves to the idol of power. That in their greed, that's what they're desiring. And so what we find then is that mankind is given to materialism, and he's given to the idea of this greed, and he's given to the ideas of the flesh. But we must be also very, very careful lest we allow even the wholesome things in this life to become our idols. Two or three of us were talking earlier this week about some of these things, and the conversation turned itself that sometimes we can actually allow a spouse to become that idol. That we become so concerned about having or getting a spouse that we allow that to destroy our lives. And suddenly it's all about this, and our lives cannot be good until this happens, and our lives can't be right until this marriage is exactly what we want it to be. And we allow something so very good and wholesome and given by God to become idolatrous to us. That's the danger that we're looking at. And I well think we're living in a time where parents have allowed their children to become their idols. The idea that my child must be involved in every possible activity, in every possible moment. And we're going to move heaven and earth to get our child to these events, and we're going to spend untold money to make this happen. Well, what's that do? What am I living for? Is it to teach that child the ways of godliness, to bring him up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord? Or is it to make sure that my child has everything every other child has? That my child stands out? That my child is the one who can hit the ball the farthest? That my child is the God? What a danger to your child. And what a danger to yourself if you make your world revolve around that. But again, here is a good and wholesome thing from God that's allowed to become an idol. I'm a little hesitant to mention this next one during fall in the South, but I'm going to anyway. Can we allow sports to become that idol? Tell you what, I come across a lot of statements, both online and even verbalized, where someone says, I live for college football season. I'm not going to judge anybody's heart, but I'm going to say be careful. Because when you start saying you live for something, that means you're obligating yourself to it. And yet even something as good, as enjoyable as this might be, what can happen? You can begin giving this your dedication, your attention. And how many Christians would willingly miss a worship service to the Lord in order to go to a game or to travel back from a game? That's the danger. And let me put one up that may sound even stranger than that. Is there a danger that your local church is becoming your idol? I look at what's happening in our world of denominational friends. And I think I've mentioned to you before, I once saw a commercial, fairly long commercial, for one of our local churches, and forget what denomination it is. For 2 minutes, they spoke about everything they do. But there was not one mention of the word God. Not one. They had everything you could possibly imagine, everything you could possibly want, everything for your kids to enjoy, everything for singles to enjoy and divorced people to enjoy. And that local church has become an idol. Because here is what I live for. Here it is to make this group really stand out amongst all of the others. Is that really our purpose? Or is it to be humble servants of God, to bring others to know Him rather than some outward fascination with the relationship that a group of people might have. This list could go on and on, but I want us to see by it. Here is the danger. Here is how easily things can become idols, the bad things that we talked about earlier, but even these good and wholesome things. So let's tie with that then. When we think about what do we live for, let's ask a second question with that, and what's our power supply? What is it that we're turning to in order to find that power? Well, in many ways, the flesh is like the pagan's narcotic. It can promise all kinds of things. It can promise all manner of happiness and joy. But in the end, it's just going to produce a shallow bitterness that what we may find pleasing for the moment is going to quickly wear away. I'm not going to deal a whole lot with the final two of these works of the flesh because we've dealt with them recently in other sermons. But you think about drunkenness and you think about this partying in a fleshly kind of way. Do people get their power from that? I need a drink to get me through the day. I need a drink to get me through the night. I need to lose myself. That's what the pagan's priest preached. Is that what I'm looking for? Is that what I'm desiring? The promise of great things, but the answer that always fails me. I think as well, so many people look at their false power supply in messages veiled as truth. That someone comes along and they say, this is how you can be right. This is how you can be happy. This is the answer. Only to find what a sad, sad source of power that is. Listen to Ezekiel. Precisely because they have misled my people, saying peace when there is no peace. And because when the people build a wall, these prophets smear it with whitewash. You see, it's been a problem for a long time. Here the false prophets would come in and they would say, oh, everything's going to be fine, and then it wasn't fine. And God says it's like whitewashing a wall. Let me tell you, there's still people whitewashing today. And we better be very careful about that. So what then do we do? How is it that you and I are going to avoid these works of the flesh, to not give ourselves to an idol, to not allow our power to come from somewhere besides God? Well, it's really quite simple when you think about it. First of all, we understand that God's got to be enthroned in the heart. Now, that may sound just kind of like a nice little phrase to say, but we got to understand what it means. That if God is enthroned in my heart, in the Bible, the idea of the heart is the totality of who I am. It's the mind and what I think. That's where God has got to be. He must be in control of everything. Listen to the problem Paul stated when he says in Romans 1:28, since they did not see fit to acknowledge God, God gave them up to a debased mind to do what ought not to be done. And of course, he's leading into a discussion of homosexuality. He says, here's the problem. Here are people who didn't enthrone God in their heart. Here are people who allowed God to be replaced with all of these fleshly, debased kinds of thoughts. And what happened? God gave them away. He said, I'll not have this. But let's look at the solution. You go to Romans chapter 12, which I guess is one of the most familiar passages in the book. And the apostle makes this admonition. He says, I appeal to you therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your, and we get a lot of variation in translations here. The older will say, who is your reasonable service? Or the newer, the spiritual worship. And that's because those ideas are very similar. But listen to what they're saying. If you think about the idea of reasonable service, what the apostle is saying is, when you take everything that you know about God and you put it to the test intellectually, it makes sense to serve Him. That's a reasonable conclusion to make. How do I enthrone God in my heart? I've got to be convinced that God deserves that position. Until I am convinced God deserves to be in control of my life, I'm never going to give it to Him. Therefore, Paul says, take everything you know about God. Understand everything there is to know about Him. And if you allow honesty to prevail, you're going to come to the conclusion that it's reasonable to serve Him. And you're going to come to the conclusion that your spiritual life being given to Him is going to be a very good investment. So how do we do that? Well, it's not only understanding who God is, but it's also running when we are tempted with the idea of idolatry. The apostle uses the same statement he made concerning fornication when he said, flee from it. He says, my beloved, flee from idolatry. When I see these problems in my life, I don't play around with them. I don't say I'm strong enough to deal with these. I get away. And once I get away, I then make sure that I am not going to allow them to come in. In fact, the Apostle John ends his short epistle of 1 John by saying, little children, keep yourselves from idols. That's one of the hardest commands in the New Testament, because idols are tempting us every day. That means we've got to remain free of the love of money and things. It means we've got to free ourselves from this lust of the flesh. We've got to free ourselves from the thirst for power. We've got to run from the idea that I'm going to allow wholesome things to become unwholesome by taking the place of God. Yet if we put these three ideas together, we understand how we walk by the Spirit. It's trusting God. And it's putting the flesh far from us. And thus, as we bring these thoughts to a conclusion, Romans chapter 1 and verse 16 is a good passage for us to consider, because here is the source of power from the one who needs to be served. I'm not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes. I don't need the pagan's narcotics. I don't need the statues of wood and stone. I don't need money. I don't need power. I don't need fleshly pursuits. What I need is God and His gospel. And when I commit myself to Him and to His saving message, it is then that I am equipped to defeat these works of God.